Accession number 9437, reel 11.
Elizabeth Hughes, tape 11. So who was in attendance then when you had your baby?
Well, there was Doug Clifford and Margaret Stanley and a lot of other people. Several Chinese nurses too, both men and women. But everything went quite straightforwardly.
How about Chinese doctors?
Well, Doug Clifford had consulted Dr. Su, who was a Western-trained obstetrician, but he passed on some useful hints to Doug, but he didn't want to examine me or be involved with me as his case. He preferred the foreigners to look after each other.
So am I right in thinking your baby would have been born in one of these caves?
Yes, in the ordinary operating theatre. And when we came out of the operating theatre about one in the morning, it had snowed, and they had quite a job carrying me and the baby back up to our cave, which was at a higher level, up these slippery paths. Yes. I mentioned earlier that we had saved a bit of petrol so that we could have some tilly lamps in the theatre while the baby was delivered. And some of the villagers had poked little holes in the paper windows to look in and see what was happening to the foreign lady. And fortunately, everything went smoothly.
Did you have any clothes for the baby?
Oh, yes. Now, they had come in when Margaret Stanley and Frank Miles came in. They bought some American Red Cross baby clothes. So David had a number of little pink and blue flannelette tops and some very, very thin nappies. I don't really know how we managed, but we did. No rubber pants or anything like that, of course. And several little soft, fleecy cotton blankets. So he had enough. And, of course, I had a basket made for him. I'd seen the woven cane baskets that they put their grain in, and I said, could they make me one sort of oval-shaped? And he had a beautiful little crib made for him. Of course, the Chinese mothers just roll the babies up in blankets and hold them close by them, but I was so afraid of rolling on him, I felt I must have him in a cot. And later, when he got a bit bigger, we were going to travel, they made a wooden sort of half crate for him to be carried on the side of a donkey.
How about feeding? Did you have enough milk to feed your
Fortunately,
baby?
I did, yes. But it was quite amusing. Whoever came to see me, male or female, the first thing they asked me was, had I got enough milk? I think they were as relieved as I was when I was able to say yes.
That indicates, doesn't it, that you were very relaxed about things?
I think so. I think it must. Yes. It really was wonderful. Margaret also stopped working in the wards for a fortnight or more to look after me and David. And so I was able to have a real rest. And it was splendid having her taking responsibility. And so I was able to sleep at night and so on, though David was a good baby.
Did it make it more difficult, though, having a baby when you had to move on?
Well, we didn't have to move. I think they organised it so that we didn't have to move until the next spring. In fact, I know they suggested perhaps we might go in February or March, and I said it was too soon, it was too cold. And so it was. That was when we were due to leave China. And so it was postponed because of the baby. Then, of course, Dad got typhus. And so it was postponed even a bit longer till he was fit to travel with us.
So the whole hospital waited, would it?
Yes. Well, I suppose so. Or possibly the hospital. No, when we moved, the hospital didn't move. The hospital stayed on. The hospital was well enough organised to stay in that place.
And when you did move, did you have any problems having a baby? How about feeding on the way? Could you just sort of sit down and...
Oh, yes, there was no problem about that. Oh. You could do it anywhere.
Yes. And could you do it quite openly? You know, would the Chinese accept?
Oh, yes. Yes, there's no problem at all.
How about, was it necessary to wean him?
Oh,
while
yes.
While you were in the situation?
Yes, you see, we didn't leave until he was about 6 or 8 months. And when it came to time, I felt he ought to be having some mixed feeding. I asked if there was any sort of cereal he could have. And I think it was Dr. Li Bing got some white floury stuff for me. And it was lotus root flour, which I made a sort of porridge out of, which was splendid. Then I said, do you think he could have some liver? And they sent a complete pig's liver for him. But I was able to feed him oddments out of our food and so on. with no problem at all. And, he didn't have noticeable tummy upsets or anything. It was splendid. He cut teeth when he ought to have done. He was a very normal baby. He did have fair hair, though, which the Chinese look on as a sign of ill health and frailty, which I suppose if a Chinese hasn't got dark hair, it really means there is something wrong with them, and which, put people off a bit. But he was a very healthy-looking baby, really.
Were there any after effects at all with your baby from this?
No, I don't think so. No.
Yes.
Well, actually, as he grew up, although his teeth were so perfect that when he was about 11, my dentist got her partners in to have a look at his teeth because they were so splendid for a child of that age. Nevertheless, his ribs were a bit nubbly, as if he'd had some sort of rickets. I suppose I hadn't given him mixed feeding early enough, and he'd lacked vitamins. Also, the light was so very strong, I was against putting him out in the sunlight, which probably may have been a bit foolish, really, because he probably suffered a bit from lack of vitamin A and D because he hadn't been in the sunlight enough.
Were you worried, though, having a small baby in these conditions, bearing in mind the cases of smallpox and typhus?
Well, it was surprising, really. There was a baby actually born in the village at the same time, almost the same day as David, who died. And I didn't hear about this till later, but really I'd never felt that anything like that would happen. And certainly David thrived. We hadn't got a proper scales, and we used to weigh him against tins of Klim powdered milk and things like that. It was great fun, but he put on weight in the prescribed manner and was really a splendid baby. And the authorities were very sympathetic and understanding. Oh, somebody made him some beautiful little red dragon shoes, which are traditional for Chinese babies, and things like that. It was wonderful. I don't know. The red material came from a blouse that belonged to Margaret Stanley, because anything like that was very difficult to get hold of. And I can't remember where the silk to do the embroidery came from.
Is red a very special colour to the Chinese?
I think so, yes. It's a very celebratory colour, yes.
If I could ask you more a little bit about your experience of village life. You have described so much, but did you ever experience sort of diversions of village life? Were there ever sort of theatres put on, opera or this?
Well,
sort of
there
thing?
Was nothing as sophisticated as that in the villages we were in, performed by the villagers. But at New Year, they did have a special ritual dance that sort of progressed right the way through the village, and men dressed up as women in beautiful old traditional embroidered costumes, which were obviously hidden away with great care for this New Year celebration every year. And they had tambourines and bells, and they did these special dances with the men taking the part of women, progressing through the village. And I think some people had masks and so on. They must have been very old traditions handed down through the generations, allied to the Chinese opera, but on a much more primitive scale, all taken very seriously, but, very much enjoyed. And it was lovely to see it because it was so absolutely real. But there were also the hospital staff themselves put on theatrical performances. They would be a wonderful mixture of very, very politically orientated stories about wicked landlords and poor ill-treated peasants and their poor daughters and so on. Very melodramatic and so on, but very much enjoyed by the people. And they would be mixed by more traditional type plays with according to what costumes and so on were available. They usually used to go on interminably, so that we wouldn't watch the whole performance. They'd take place in the summer when there wouldn't be any artificial light needed, because anything like that was very difficult.
Did you ever gain any impression how the local landlords in these various areas were regarded by the communists?
Well, they were very badly regarded and ill-treated. There were one or two cases of really severe ill-treatment, which I put down partly to absolute lack of facilities for any kind of form of recreation or outlets for energies and so on. Someone who was reputed to have been a spy, I think it was actually stoned to death in a village near us, in a village where another part of the hospital was housed. And in our own village, there were two people accused of being landlords, and they were hung up by their thumbs for 12 hours at a time or something. And that was rather horrible. But I think, really, that the people thought it was rather amusing at the time, I think they were quite ashamed of it afterwards. And, of course, in an area as poor as that, it was so difficult to see that anyone had made money out of anyone because nobody had anything. In other areas where there were some rich as well as the poor, it's more understandable, but there it can only really have been an outlet for energies that had no outlet. But Dr. Marr, that's George Harton, who we met later and reported this to, he said, oh, no, the people's courts have not got the right to pass a death sentence, and that stoning should not have taken place. But I don't suppose there would have been any retribution under the circumstances.
You mentioned earlier how you were beginning to respect the communists, you know, seeing their sort of organisation and various programmes. Was this reinforced while you were on the move?
Yes, well, often we as you can see, we stayed in lots of different villages, and peasants would come and talk to us through an interpreter. And we were always given the impression that they were pleased to have the communists, who treated them fairly, and compared them with the Kuomintang, who had taxed them 50 years ahead and so on, and who you couldn't rely on them. And when we had been in nationalist territory, I think I mentioned that people dreaded the Kuomintang army coming through because they took everything, while the communists were always very circumspect and only took what they could pay for, and acted in a very fair way to them, to the peasants.
You mentioned also that you treated Kuomintang soldiers. This implies that the communists were caring for them, you know.
Yes, well,
same as their own.
That was quite a political propaganda point, because they would be prepared to take the young Kuomintang soldiers and treat them well, and certainly in other areas they'd return them over the lines to their own groups later. I don't think that could have been done up there because of the isolated areas, but anyway, the Kuomintang prisoners were treated very well. Just like the other soldiers, and after all, they were all peasants together, probably.
Do you know of any cases of Kuomintang that stayed on, you know, that joined the communist forces? Would that have been the?
I don't quite know what would have happened. I think they would have been invited to join the Kuomintang, the communist forces.
You were saying how earlier in Yan'an there was no attempt made to indoctrinate you with communists, you know,
no.
The communist programme. Mm. Did that continue to
it
be
did.
The case?
Yes, it did continue the whole time, yes. Obviously they would put their point of view, and they would say, you know, we've done this and it's much better than the Kuomintang, but they didn't push their philosophy at all.
Were you getting news of what was happening in the wider picture of China? You know, for instance, this when you were getting into 1948, were you learning of the communist successes?
Yes. Yes, our interpreter used to get what news he could from the whole world, but particularly of nationalist communist victories over the nationalists, because the communist held areas of China were spreading quite rapidly by the summer of 1948. When we were on the march once, we saw large groups of people similarly dressed, but not in uniform, carrying grain as much as they could carry, and we were told that they were carrying this food to an area where there was starvation and special need. But it was pointed out to us that you cannot supply a famine area if it's too far away and too difficult to get to, because the people who carry the grain in have to be fed for the journey in and the return journey, and you can't supply people from too far away, otherwise the people who are carrying it will consume everything that they can carry. But it was interesting that food on quite a considerable scale was being organised by the communists to send to a devastated area. I didn't know the details, but it was obviously a highly organised arrangement. The sort of thing that the communists did very well.
Could I ask you now about going back to Yan'an? Now, you have indicated earlier that you returned to Yan'an after this very long march
yes.
that you'd had, staying in the different villages with the hospital.
Mm. Well, when it was time that we all returned to Europe. Margaret Stanley and Frank Miles had already gone in the early spring of 1948. So there was only Doug and Eric and myself left. The hospital was running quite smoothly in that area, and our leaving, I don't think, made... Oh, we had to wait for a doctor to come, I believe, to take over from Doug. And then we had decided we'd like to return to Yan'an before we set off. That would mean travelling southwest before we travelled east and north again to get back to the Nationalist held territories. We walked, I think, all the way, or most of the way, back to Yan'an, having to cross the Yellow River on the barges again. And when we got to Yan'an, we found that during the nationalist occupation, almost all the large buildings had been destroyed, burnt down, razed to the ground, including the operating theatre at the hospital where we had worked. Since then, of course, most of the buildings have been rebuilt. But it was real wartime devastation, like the London bombing and so on. It was very sad. But there were very, very cheerful people there ready to welcome us, including there was a General Ho Lung who gave us a dinner. I think, is that the right name? Yes, I think it's Ho Lung. Yes. And we were very much feted, and David was considered a wonderful baby by all and sundry. And we had to wait in Yan'an for a truck to come and take us on the first part of our journey to Shijiazhuang. Before I go on to the journey, when we were in Yan'an, we had a wonderful opportunity to see a real genuine Peking opera. It was a really exciting experience. They had all the old traditional costumes and wonderful performers. A lot of the parts are taken by small boys, very exhausting parts too. And there's the most wonderful acrobatic, athletic dancing and fights. And also there were a lot of traditional things like if you're holding a peacock feather, it means something. If you're holding a long pheasant feather, various attitudes and things have special meanings, which I'm afraid I've never learned. And I really must find out more about it. But they're very, very exciting. There was an enormous crowd watching this opera. And the music is all cymbals and drums and a few wind instruments and so on. Very, very, it can be very, very noisy. I know I was fascinated because there were mothers with their babies in their arms watching this opera. And the babies just slept through this fantastic din. It was really very, very exciting indeed, especially after the stark austerity of the previous 18 months. It was really a wonderful experience. In fact, it seemed absolutely unreal.
Were any of the big names there in Yan'an at the time? Judy?
I don't think Judy and Joe and I were there then, no, I don't think so. I think they would have been further south or further west. Mm. Certainly Ma wasn't there.
Did you still have the feeling, though, that it was an important
place?
Oh,
certainly, yes. The impression of the early years of communism and so on were right there still in that town. And people were very eager to get it back to its former glory and to rebuild the halls of the people and so on that had been there.
Your impression of Yan'an during those years, you know, and the particularly on the march as well, the conditions you were working in and the way you coped with the various problems, do you think there were lessons there for, say, the Third World today?
Yes, I do. I think you can manage on much less than you think you can, and also it's important that you when you think of the things you do need, to get your priorities right and not go for some sophisticated things, but to try and find the basic essentials and strive for them and forget all the twiddly bits.
It seems to me from what you've been describing that all the time you were working within the Chinese culture as much as possible. Am
yes.
I right in thinking
oh, yes.
that?
I think we felt that we didn't want to impose our ideas on them, but we wanted to live by their standards. We didn't entirely achieve it, but we were very willing to try.
It was really quite ambitious, wasn't it, you know, the team going as part of that hospital. Can you see any improvements that could have been made, you know, in your sort of relationship to the hospital? If you had been, say, an independent unit, would that have made it more easy for you?
I don't think so. I think it was better to be directly responsible to the Chinese there. I think if we could have spoken more Chinese, which I mean, my Chinese was very poor, I think language is a great benefit if you don't need to go through an interpreter.
I was thinking of the Kala Azar teams that went, and they operated very much as independent
yes,
units,
they did.
Didn't they?
Yes.
I was wondering if there were any advantages of that over your situation.
Yes, well, of course, they weren't operating in a war situation. They were in a peacetime situation. And that made it very different. I think there, particularly if they'd been in communist China, it would have been different. But in nationalist China, they wouldn't have got support from the government. They had to push for everything they wanted. While in communist China, it was different. You only had to suggest something, and they would try and carry out your ideas immediately, if it were possible.
Were there ever occasions when you conflicted with the communists, you know, that you disagreed with them?
I don't think there were often any suggestions that weren't carried out. The only thing was there were often delays, which were not really anyone's fault. They're often caused by the weather. And also the Chinese habit of wanting to please people when they've asked for things and promising more than they were able to fulfil.
Is this tied up with face?
I think so, yes. And although the communists say that it's dead, it just isn't. It lingers in the basic character of the Chinese, that they this business of face and also of wanting to please your guest.
Was it very important to understand that, do you think, in order to get along with the Chinese, to recognise that they had this concept of face?
I think there would be misunderstandings if you ignored it.
Did that experience have lasting effects on your life, do you think? Your time in Yan'an and the Yan'an area?
In a way, it was so utterly different from my life in England that it almost had a dreamlike quality when we got home, because England was so different with the war over and everything changing so very rapidly here, and my circumstances so utterly different with a family and a husband out at work all day, and no proper housing, you know. We had got a house after several years, but not immediately. And, you know, living in furnished rooms. It was all so very different. Really, our experiences in China were like a dream. And it's only later that things gradually slipped into place and we began to watch what was happening in China and how things were going and relating it to our own experiences.
I was wondering if it affected your attitude to sort of materialism, the fact that you had lived so simply and seemingly so happily and you'd had a baby in a cave and everything had worked out so well.
Yes.
Do you think you emerged as a less materialistic person?
Possibly. It certainly made going, you know, having to do without things in England when we got home, because, of course, there was still rationing and everything when we were home. It really didn't seem so terribly difficult. It all seemed... We were pleased that everything was so equitably distributed in England. And it made having to go without things like carpets and so on much easier than I think than it would have been possibly if we'd lived in a more affluent society. But I suppose if we'd stayed in England all the time, it would all have been a gradual change. But it certainly has made me always question how much is enough, because I think that is a very difficult question to answer. When I think how we live there, it makes you realise how very little can be enough.
Yes, talking of equity, were all the animals equal?
Well, not entirely. As I say, when Dr. Joe broke his wrist, Petrol was found to X-ray his wrist, you see. But it wasn't very noticeable. There were only the rare incidents like that. And then, as I say, the uniforms. I was surprised when the interpreter said that our uniforms were majors' ranks and, you know, some of the others were privates' ranks and so on. It wasn't terribly noticeable. There were only minute refinements. And, of course, we did get better food. The hospital staff were often fed only two meals a day, and we always had three meals a day. If there was very little meat, we would get meat and eggs more than the other people.
And something I haven't asked you, the hospital patients, did they have to pay?
I don't think so. Although the chinless wonder I was talking about, I know he had been in a position where he'd sold his... he had a watch and rings and things, and he had sold those to get food. But I don't think he was charged for his hospital treatment. I don't really know what where his income would have come from, nor where the income of the patients would have come from. If they were soldiers, presumably medical treatment was all free. And I don't know what peasants did when they came. I never heard anything about payment.